You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
James Lewis Yang.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new, easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Cleveland, Ohio, 2006. After a chance encounter, three people soon find out that life can sometimes thrust us into the public eye, even when taking great measures to avoid it. Cooper Madison was the best pitcher in baseball after being drafted number one overall in 1996 from the small Gulf Coast town of Pass Christian, Mississippi. 1 year after announcing his sudden and shocking retirement, he finds himself seeking anonymity in Cleveland, Ohio. Kara Knox is the youngest sibling to three older brothers. After a tragic work accident to her closest relative, she has built up a tough exterior as she begins her final year of college at Cleveland State University. Jason Knox, Kara's oldest brother, is the lead detective on Cleveland's Edgewater Park killer case. After months without a suspect, he's feeling the heat from his media-hungry chief. Serendipity intervenes, and all three learn that perception and reality are paths that rarely ever intersect. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Hey folks, you really ought to check out Patricia Gillum's Heroes of Corvus series. Book one is called A Superhero's Duty, a fight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of three innocent civilians and orphaning a six-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the death of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city are not out of danger. A Superhero's Duty, Book 1 of the Heroes of Corvus by Patricia Gillum. Get this series now. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Gene Lewin Yang on the show back with us today. He was on a couple of years ago talking about writing Superman for DC Comics, one of my favorite shows that we've gotten to do over the years. Gene has an amazing new graphic novel. It's called Dragon Hoops, And this is one of the most inventive, innovative books that I've read in quite a while, and it was such a joy to get in the mail. Welcome back to the show, Gene.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Hank, and thank you for reading Dragon Hoops.
Absolutely. It was so much fun. Before we dig into all of that, can you tell us what the first comic that you read that completely won you over to this format, this style of literature, and what, you know, and why that made such a big impact on you?
I can tell you about two different ones. One was DC Comics Presents number 57, starring Superman and the Atomic Knights. That's the very first comic of my collection. My mom bought it for me off of a spinner rack at a local bookstore when I was in fifth grade. And that really started me on my comic book journey. But what really kind of flipped me and made me think about comics in a new and different way, especially as a creator, was Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud, which I read in early college. I'm not totally sure I'd be making comics had I not read that book at that time.
That's incredible. I recently watched your TEDx talk on why comics belong in the classroom. As someone who is an artist, you have also been an educator. How have comics, and since we're talking about a book that's aimed at you know, middle graders to young adults, how have comics, you know, just tell us about your experience with comics in the classroom, because that video was so eye-opening, and especially from your perspective.
You know, as a cartoonist and an educator, it really has been great to see a more widespread adoption of comics into American classrooms. I think it really, like this current wave of comics coming into school libraries and into teachers' curricula, really began maybe in the 90s. And before that, there was really this dearth. Most teachers avoided comics at all costs. This change has just been awesome. It's been awesome to see. I have been especially interested in seeing comics in reading, like reluctant reader settings. I think that's a great way to begin using comics. But I also do think comics are a medium worthy of study in and of themselves. You know, some of the most innovative teachers that I've ever met have been using comics as a way of teaching visual literacy. We're in an increasingly visual world. In order for us to parse our visual information well, comics are a great tool for learning that.
Gene, why do you think there's so much hesitation? And that's changing, obviously. But why is there so much hesitation to include comics?
You know, when I was a kid, my immigrant dad used to complain that the words were too small and they would damage my eyesight. I don't know if there's any scientific backing about for that particular view. But I think in America, there is a weird history that comics has had with the American classroom. And it really dates back to the 1950s. So in the 1950s, there was a book that came out called Seduction of the Innocent, written by a child psychologist, where the book's main argument is that comic books cause juvenile delinquency. We know, of course, that that is not the case. But that book was so impactful that it really did lead to this avoidance of comics in educational settings for decades and decades and decades. The same thing did not happen in France or in Japan. Now, both of those countries really do love comics. And in those countries, comics have been a part of what their school systems do for a very, very long time. But for us here in America, it really is just beginning.
Gene, I know that you started as a programmer, but you always had a love of art, and comics was a medium that always drew you. And you've even incorporated your love of programming with comics, with the Secret Coders project and stuff like that. But what was it that you know, won you over and made you want to leave programming to pursue art?
You know, so I was I did major in computer science in college, and shortly after I graduated, I became a computer programmer. I became a software engineer. I did that for about 2 years before moving on to teaching high school computer science. And I was a teacher for 17 years, so I did that for a very, very long time. With the Secret Coder series that you mentioned, I took what I used to do in my computer science classroom and I put it into the form of a graphic novel. So that series is really aimed at middle grade kids. We want to teach them the basics of computer science through a graphic novel format. I think, you know, I still really love programming. That's why I did the Secret Coder series. And I do feel, yeah, you know, I definitely didn't move on. I'm no longer professionally programming. I haven't done it in, I don't know, almost 2 decades now. But I do see a lot of overlap between software development and making comics. You know, both of these things really require you to take complex ideas and break them up into concrete chunks that are then put in sequence. In programming, you do that with code, and in making comics, you do that with panels. So, my immigrant dad, he really wanted me to get that computer science degree. And I do think a part of him is sad that I'm not actually using it in a professional setting. But then again, I kind of am. You know, I think those skills that I got from learning programming in college, I am still using in a strange way in making comics.
I love that connection between programming and comics and how one is still informing the other. That's a beautiful coalescence. You kind of broke out on the comic scene with this graphic novel, American Born Chinese. What was the impetus for that book? What was the catalyst that got that going?
Well, I started American Born Chinese in the year 2000, and at that point, I'd been doing comics for about 5 years. It was more of a hobby than anything. I mean, I took it more seriously than a hobby, but it was definitely not a moneymaker for me. Every time I put out a comic, I'd lose anywhere between a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. But I'd still do it because I loved comics. I'd done all these stories with Asian American protagonists, but their cultural heritage never really played a role in the story. So that's what American Born Chinese is me talking about my own Asian American heritage in a very explicit way. I did it as a Xerox comic to begin with. So while I was working on it, I'd finish a chapter. I'd take it to my local Kinko's. I'd run it off. I'd staple them into books by hand, and then I'd sell them. I'd sell maybe, I don't know, 16 copies of every one of these issues that I would do. So to go from there to eventually having it as a full-color graphic novel from a publisher, from First Second Books, was kind of mind-blowing to me. And even more mind-blowing than that, really honestly, is was the response that that book got. You know, librarians and teachers and comic book store owners, readers, all came out to support that book, and that really did pave the way for me to become a full-time cartoonist that I am today. It was life-changing, absolutely life-changing.
Gene, I've heard you talk about how reading comics or a graphic novel puts the reader in charge of the flow of time, if you will, and the reader's in charge of moving forward and backward and slowing things down, or, you know, taking one panel and giving it more in-depth study and really putting the reader in charge. The format, I've never written a graphic novel, even though I'm a huge comics fan. You know, when you're writing a prose novel, some people are plotters and planners, and some people kind of write by the seat of their pants. But most people, you know, have some sort of way of tracking notes and ideas and things like that. And they find some way to you track the flow of the story. When you're thinking in terms of a graphic novel, and I know that you illustrate as well as write all of the dialogue, how does that conceptualize for you, and how do you plan out a graphic novel?
Oh, I am definitely on the planner side of things. You know, I definitely outline. When I first started doing comics, I did not. I did kind of make it up as I went along. But then I kept getting my characters into these corners, and I would have no idea how to get them out. And I have found that doing a fairly tight outline is very helpful for that. So now I will write an outline. Like for a 200-page graphic novel, the outline will be maybe 6 pages typed. And when I'm actually writing the graphic novel, I'll often deviate from what I had written in that outline. But what that outline does for me is it gives me confidence that there is an ending out there. You know, that was a fear that I always had when I used to make things up as I went along. I'd be going along and wondering, is there going to be an ending? Am I going to be able to find an ending? But now I know at least there is one out there that I can default to if I need to. I do think that among my cartoonist friends, most of us are outliners, but there are definitely exceptions. One of the most notable ones in the world of comics is a guy named Joan Safar. He's a French cartoonist, and he makes things up as he goes along. But for whatever reason, his subconscious is able to figure out these beautiful story structures underneath what he's doing. My subconscious just doesn't work as well, so I have to outline.
In the book American Born Chinese, that book is not necessarily about you, though I think it's probably fair to assume that it was informed by your life and by your experiences. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely fiction. I've never met the Monkey King, you know, but a lot of what happens to one of the protagonists is a young boy who's going through junior high. So a lot of those experiences are taken directly from my life.
As opposed to Dragon Hoops, your new book that we're talking about today, which is absolutely about you. Tell me about the decision to write a graphic novel memoir of this period in your life.
You know, there's some great graphic novel memoirs out there now. The work of Raina Telgemeier comes to mind, and Shannon Hale and Lee Wen Pham. You know, they're honest and they're raw and they're funny. And I've been a fan of these folks for a while. I've been a fan of memoir comics and memoir graphic novels for a while. But I always thought that I didn't have the courage to do it. I just think, you know, I just thought about writing about my own life and about the actual people that I see on a daily basis. I was still kind of scared about it. So then this opportunity comes up. The school where I was teaching, the men's varsity basketball team started a season that everybody was talking about, so I found this story. And originally, I had planned on just focusing on the coaches and the players. I was not planning on being a part of the story at all. But then as I went on, as I was following this team over the season, I realized that as a storyteller, I had all sorts of weaknesses. I had holes in my perspective, you know. One of the big ones was, I am not a basketball guy. I did not grow up watching basketball or playing basketball. I didn't even know that much about basketball when I began the project. I was really just attracted to an exciting story. And then the second weakness is, you know, I'm an Asian American kid. I grew up in a suburb, and that team was fairly diverse. Some of those kids had suburban childhoods like I did, but then there were other kids that grew up in the flatlands of Oakland who had very, very different childhood experiences. And in a lot of ways, I think I just didn't have a lot of overlap with them, you know, and I felt like that was a weakness, and I needed to be real about that. So ultimately, the best way to be real, I found, was to actually insert myself into the narrative so that, you know, cartoon me could talk to the reader about what I was and wasn't able to access, what I was and wasn't able to understand.
You talked about in that TEDx video that I mentioned earlier that making assignments for your students, and there was a point where cartoon you almost connected with your students better than real you. And you kind of make a joke about it and, you know, kind of poke fun at yourself with that. Was there a point with Dragon Hoops where cartoon you kind of took on a life of his own?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, in the TEDx video, I do talk about how, you know, I do these cartoon lectures. So I basically draw these lectures as comic strips, and then I also deliver lectures in person. And for some of those students, at least, they definitely preferred the cartoon version of me. With the cartoon version of me in Dragon Hoops, I think just like any other cartoon, right? Like, cartoons at their essence are like a distillation or a simplification of real life. The drawing itself is simple, is simpler than what you would see with your eyes. But what you're trying to do is use that simplicity to capture the essence of something. So what I was hoping to do with the cartoon version of Me and Dragon Hoops was capture the essence of what I was going through as I was writing that book, you know. And I think the effect that Cartoon Me had on real me was that it did help me understand the creative process a little bit better. Anytime an author writes a book or a cartoonist writes and draws a graphic novel, at the beginning it feels like we're doing it for the first time again. So it's always nice to really think deeply about that process because it'll help on a future project. And I think that definitely happened for me, in part because of Cartoon Me, you know.
The book is, I'm reaching behind me here to grab it off the shelf, is just phenomenal. I mean, it's like 450 pages, like a couple of pages shy, I think of 450, hardback graphic novel. And I mean, it's amazing. It's such a gorgeous, presentation when it's all, put together there. At what point did this project come alive for you as you're going through this basketball season? Did it dawn on you then? Or is this, you know, a time of reflection afterward? When did you kind of see the encapsulation of, oh, there's a story there?
Well, you know, the bookmaking that you mentioned, I can't really take credit for. The hardback and the book jacket, all of that was designed by First Second Books, my publisher. And the cover specifically was designed by a guy named Kurt Benchoff. He's amazing. So he's the one that figured out all the textures so that the book itself will kind of feel like a basketball. When I got that through the mail, when I held that first copy in my hand, I was shocked at what they had done. It's really an amazing package that they put together.
I bet you were giddy. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's like I've never had that much gold foil on one of my comics. It was crazy to see. It was crazy to see for the first time. But for me, I made a commitment at the very beginning of the season that I was going to do a graphic novel, you know, and I was debating between doing a nonfiction version of what I was seeing or fictionalizing everything so I could have a little bit more control over the plot. And then as I got to know the coaches, as I got to know the players, as the season progressed, I realized, man, there's a lot of drama just in the real life version. There's no reason for me to fictionalize any of it. But I did have a lot of doubts all the way through, which I do talk about in the book. You know, I was really worried about figuring out what that ending would be. One of the things that I do when I'm writing fiction is I will figure out what the ending is pretty early on, and then I'll write to that ending. So I'll do foreshadowing. It'll form how the rest of the plot is structured, right? But with this, because it's nonfiction, because it's a real-world story, I didn't have that kind of control. So all the way through, I was like trying to map out all the different possible endings of the season and then figuring out how I would structure the rest of the book in order to support that ending.
It's absolutely fantastic. The end product is, it reads like a movie, you know, and we're in interesting times now where we have movies, whole franchises that are based on comic books that you and I read growing up. And we live in a time where movie making can finally catch up to comics. And it's kind of a funny thing to say, but you can now do on screen what people have been drawing on the page for forever. And you can do it fairly believably on screen. As a comics creator, how do you balance action with some of the more introspective, parts of the story, and talk about drawing action and the representing kind of the excitement of a game on the page is pretty incredible what you pull off.
Yeah, I'm sure you feel this way too, right? As a lifelong comic book reader, to see movies with our favorite heroes from childhood actually work, where they don't look goofy, they actually look cool on the screen, is unbelievable. You know, when I was in high school, I never would have guessed that we would see a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. You know, that was such an obscure comic in the 80s and 90s, and now it's like a worldwide franchise. It's kind of mind-blowing. But I do think what that does for comics is it makes it so that we have to rely on other strengths. In the 80s and the 70s, comic book superhero action was hard to replicate on the movie screen in a believable way, right? So comics really, I think superhero comics at the time really showed off the strengths of the medium. You know, when you read a story about Superman, you could believe that he was flying. But when you saw him on the screen, sometimes he looked kind of fake. Now, because of computer technology, that particular advantage of comics has been erased. So I think we have to rely on other things. And one of the things that I think comics does very well is intimacy. You know, when you are reading a comic, you are actually reading the movements of the cartoonist's hand. And a well-made comic can feel as intimate as a diary, I think. So I do think creators like Raina Telgemeier and Shannon Hale and Lee Wen Fan, they really do leverage that. When you read their comics, you really do feel like you're getting an intimate glimpse into their lives. So I was trying to do that as well with Dragon Hoops. You know, I tried to draw in a slightly rougher style than I used for Boxers and Saints, which was the graphic novel I illustrated immediately before this. And I really tried to kind of capture the intimacy of my conversations with the coaches and the players in the book.
Gene, why are comics or graphic novels the ideal medium for discussing race and diversity? What is it about this medium that gives us more of an open door, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of great stories about race and about culture told in lots of different media. You know, the work of our current National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Jason Reynolds, comes to mind. But I think what's unique in comics and graphic novels is that you actually see it, you know? You can actually see the characters. And in a lot of ways, the characters don't even have to actually be talking about these big issues, and you can still be aware of it. In Dragon Hoops in particular, that wasn't really something that I was looking to do at the beginning of the season. I really just wanted to tell an exciting sports story. But then real-world issues like cultural differences and race did come into that story almost unexpectedly, at least in certain cases. Like, for instance, right before one of the games that I detail in the book, the Ferguson decision was announced. And it kind of came out of nowhere. Nobody was expecting it. It came, and it did have an effect on that game that was played the next day. Even though nobody talked about it, even though it wasn't addressed explicitly by the coach or by the announcer at the game, it was a part of what was happening on the court. And in comics, you can kind of show that without explicitly talking about it.
And I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to look at a story and see someone like you or even see someone different from you, and then to see the story kind of come alive, and some of those things just soak in and just kind of become the way we think instead of being told what to think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think the best stories that we have will leave a spot for readers to do their own work. We'll give the reader a little bit of space.
Do you think we're seeing advances in education, Gene, where comics are being more accepted and educators are finding new ways to incorporate that medium into the way we teach?
Absolutely. I think that's happening. I think on most campuses, people are at least realizing that comic books and graphic novels can be useful in reluctant reader settings. So they're bringing them in to engage kids that otherwise wouldn't be reading. But I do think there are broader applications of comics. I think comics are a great way of teaching visual literacy, of teaching kids to be very critical about the visual media that surrounds them, to not always simply believe what they see, you know, especially through a screen. I think comics are a great way of doing that. Is that something that you've heard from other educators as well?
Absolutely. My son is a middle school English teacher, and he's you know, finding ways to use comics in his classroom.
Yeah. I think all of that is super exciting, especially for, you know, I grew up in the 80s. We had to go to the comic book store to get comics. Now you can find them in school libraries, which is just mind-blowing to me.
Absolutely, it is. Gene, now that this book is out and it kind of off your plate, what are you working on now?
Well, I am prepping for another book that will be out in a couple months. It's called Superman Smashes the Klan. It's from DC Comics, and it's a retelling of a classic story from the 1940s Superman radio show. Have you read the book Freakonomics?
Oh,
do you know the book?
Yes.
Yeah, so in Freakonomics, they talk about it for a whole chapter. They talk about this one storyline. In that storyline, a Chinese-American family moves into Metropolis. Superman, or after this Chinese-American family moves in, a group of hooded racists gets really angry about it. They burn a cross on this family's lawn. And then Superman and his friends at the Daily Planet and this Chinese-American family, they all team up to take down the Klan of Metropolis. So this story, the reason why I was in Freakonomics is because it had real-world consequences. Supposedly, after this story aired, the real-world membership of the Klan dropped. Nobody wanted to be part of a group that was an enemy of Superman. And even though it's considered one of the most important stories about Superman that's ever been told, it's never been told through comics. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm teamed up with a fabulous art studio called Guri Hiru, and we're doing it as a middle grade graphic novel that'll be out in May.
I'm so excited to see that, and I know a lot of people are too. That's been one of the Superman stories that's been told and retold, and like you said, we've never gotten to see it in comics, so I'm super excited to see that come out. Gene, I know you've got to run to another interview, but if people want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, where can they connect with you online?
Well, you know, I do have a website. It's my name, GeneLuenYang.com, GeneLuenYang. I'm also on Twitter and on Instagram at that same handle. And on Instagram right now, I'm doing a cartoon book tour. So my in-person book tour got canceled because of all the coronavirus stuff. So we decided to do it as a cartoon. So I'm presenting as a series of cartoon strips all the things that I would have talked about had I been able to visit different communities in person.
I love it. Love it. We're going to put links to all that great stuff in the show notes of this episode. Gene, thank you so much for what you do, and thank you for taking time to come back on the show.
Thank you, Hank. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.